Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the AMAA Martial Arts Masters Blog Talk Radio Show, hosted by the American Martial Arts Alliance, dedicated to building the awareness of professionalism in the martial arts through martial arts management and student development.
Aloha, everyone. This is Professor Gary Lee, talking to you live from the Sport Karate Museum Archives. Welcome to another AMAA Pioneers and Legends Archives Radio Show, where we feature the personal and update interviews with some of the stars of yesteryear and the stars of today. This year we're doing something very special, celebrating various things throughout the year. And we started off from November 21st to December 21st as celebrating Martial Arts History Month. And we're asking anyone to get in contact with someone from the old days, 60s, 70s, 80s. I guess that was considered the old days. To give them a call, email them, tell them how much you appreciate them, and wish them a happy holidays. And we've got some upcoming shows coming up. They're going to be pretty exciting. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But my producer tonight, Master Jesse Bowen, wanted me to mention that every show that I get to do, I get to do something really special for the book, The Who's Who in Martial Arts. And I like to say that we're officially now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And this week in this show, if you buy two books, we're going to give you one free. That's right. If you buy two books, one for one of your family and maybe one for someone very special to you in the martial arts, we're going to give you one free. And to call Jesse Bowen on that directly, if you like, you may call him at 919-618-8075. And if you'd like to call in today and talk to my special guest tonight, you may call in at 657-383-1410. We have a couple new segments tonight also that we're introducing. We'll have the Legends name game, of course, but we're also introducing upcoming events. And also, we've gotten quite a few emails in, and we'd like to answer some of those emails tonight, too, for our listeners. We'd like to talk about the upcoming guests coming ahead before we go into our special guest tonight. And just a little sentence on each one. Mr. A.J. Perry is coming up our next interview in the 1st of January. Excuse me. 1st of December, and he's an Ohio resident, well-known in Tang Soo-do martial arts and a history general for the Sport Karate Museum. We have Mr. Andrew Finelli, just put on one of the largest events of martial art masters in the All-Pro Taekwondo Hall of Fame. Colonel Phil Torres, retired, but is an advocate and history general for the Sport Karate Museum, also runs the shooting competitions throughout America. Sifu Goldenberg, the 1st of January, getting ready for his upcoming event, the Action Martial Arts Hall of Fame, probably the largest martial arts extravaganza that the world has really known in the past few years. One of the great fighters from the 70s, legendary Monster Man Everett Eddy, super new producer in the martial arts and fitness reform, and that's Mr. Bill Viola, who does the Kumite Classic. Old-timer again, Mr. Jim Buten. We'll be talking about his new book that he just written. Mr. Bob Liker from American Kick, one of the great fighters and great producers today. Mr. Mike Dillard, owner of Century Martial Arts, and that's a very special interview, talking about how he started in the garage and worked out to be the largest martial arts, supplier in the world. Mr. Jerry Trimble Jr., one of the great full contact pioneers and fighters. Mr. Harry Mock, actor, author, supreme stuntman, amazing man. Don DeVries and the Superfoot Tournament. That's going to be one of my favorite interviews because I'm a big fan of Superfoot. But Don DeVries and Richard McClain are responsible for honoring Superfoot every year now in Cleveland, Ohio. I have a very special guest tonight, and it's not really dealing with sport karate, even though it is sport that he does do for the Century Martial Arts people and, of course, what he does throughout the country, around the world. And this gentleman is a living samurai. He is trained in Japan and most advocate with the sword. He's the owner of Samurai Sports, and we've been friends going on almost 30 years, starting in very humble beginnings, and very interesting man. And I'm bringing on Shihan Dana Abbott. Dana, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing?
Aloha, brother. How are you? I'm right off the bat. I promised some of my listeners that called in, I am not going to make fun of your name because it's a girl's name. Because
it's
I know
it's okay.
What
I'm used to
that.
It by now. After 60 years of being Dana, I can live with it.
It's always a good note to start off our interviews with that said.
Hey, you know, that's how I got into martial arts, so that's how it is.
That's what we're going to talk about tonight a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about how you got started. And that right off the bat, I mean, for the people who don't know who you are, I'll hit some bullet points. You train in Japan. You're the owner of Samurai Sports, and that is I would call that a teaching institute. I know you sell a lot of product, but you are a master's instructor. I've followed you for years, and you teach at the online university. You travel the world with your seminars and passing on the martial arts. I love your authorship. Particularly, we'll talk about the 47 Ronin and my contribution to that. And also some of your escapades and adventures around the world.
Well, that's always a fun thing to talk about there.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. But right off the bat, for the listeners who don't know Shihan Dana Abbott, I'd like to ask the beginning and how it started for you in the martial arts. And I know it just didn't just start with a sword in your hand, but tell my listeners how it started and give them a little explanation of who is Dana Abbott from the beginning.
Well, probably the first time I ever saw martial arts was judo over at UC Berkeley about 1964. I have an older brother, and he practiced, and guess who he brought along to throw around? So I learned the basic falls, how not to fall down the stairs and not how to get, you know, when the brother pushes you, how not to fall incorrectly. And then never did it again until I got out of Arizona State in 1978 and went up to a small town called Prescott, Arizona, and started working for the county there in the engineering department. And there is where, if you remember those movies like Billy Jack, remember that nasty little town that didn't want him there? That was Prescott, Arizona. So I started learning.
There's a real city there, huh?
Okay. Oh, yeah,
okay.
It's a real city. It's a real city. And it's pretty big now. It's a pretty big town. But nevertheless, I started doing it at the Police Athletic League at the Armory there, and then one thing led to another, and I ended up in Japan.
Now, how did you end up in Japan?
Well, I just had this burning urge to do weaponry. See, when I was doing basic punch and kick, and it was called Korean karate back then, and I did this and that, and I got beat up pretty well. And then after a while, they started introducing weapons to me, and I tried this weapon, that weapon, but the weapon that fit my hand best was the wooden sword. So with that, I started running with the wooden sword.
With the bokken. Cool.
Yeah, with a boken and or bokuto, depending on how you say it. And lo and behold,
How do you pronounce it?
Bokuto.
Bokuto. Okay.
Yeah, it's the counting of a to is a counting of swords. Boken is wood sword. Bokuto is one sword or wood sword. So it's a little different. I think boken is more Chinese, and bokuto is original Japanese thought process.
That's right there. The listeners have learned something brand new.
Trust me. I wasn't a history professor. I just got beat up a lot over there.
That's true, but you picked up a lot of knowledge now.
Oh, yeah.
The training in Japan is one of the questions I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
The training in Japan is much different from the training in America, and not to downgrade America, because I would never do that. I love America, and I love the attitude of karate in America. Yes. But the training in Japan is much different. Explain that to my listeners, that the difference of, say, the Bokuto or the Boken
or Bokuto.
Or just the draw itself. How much is the difference with training?
Well, the treatment is completely different because it's mostly through the Japanese Department of Education. Like here in the United States, at one time they had electives where you had to do physical education. You had to do track or field or baseball or football. Same thing in Japan. And lo and behold, all the kids have either judo or kendo. If you have a fast metabolism, you do kendo. If you have a slower metabolism and like the role, you do more judo, but still it's an individual but team sport that allows you to deal with other people by the time you get older, and it also teaches you how to take care of your body. And it isn't about hitting other people and doing this as much. It's about not slipping in the snow or not getting hit by a car because you're paying better attention to your surroundings. So they teach
awareness.
That to their
–
yes. Pardon me?
Teaching awareness.
Teaching awareness and teaching your mind and body to work together so they all become good students and good people of society, and that's how they run it over there. And if you don't do it, it's okay, but you lose face a lot. And losing face is much more worse than taking off that extra 10 minutes. So when we train over here in the United States, it's always around the student, you know, what his needs are in this. Over there, it's around the needs of the many, and you need to learn it this way and only this way, because later down the road, you'll probably be teaching at a high school, a junior high school, or a college.
Good. Excellent point. Now, what is the time level normally between the student going from book and to drawing the sword?
Well, they don't usually draw swords. Kids don't draw swords. That's an older guy's job as a general rule. When you first start out, say you first start out in kendo, and your dad did kendo, just because everybody's dad did kendo or judo, but I'm around the kendo people, so they did kendo. So then you worked with bamboo and a little wood because you had to learn some of the katas, because you can't go up in rank without any of the katas. But you mostly spend 90% of your time on, you know, the bamboo pole, just, you know, smacking everybody over and over and over with a single men shot. So from five years old to maybe 10 years old, you'd be just doing main shots. But you get so good, and your arms and your rote sets in really, really well. When they get the wood, and they're using it more for, as I said earlier, kata. But the cool thing about it is that's when they turn teenagers, they really start pushing out kata a little bit more. Drawing a mogito, a fake sword, or a shinken, a real sword, is a little done when you're in your late teens, early 20s, not too much. But most people that stay with it, usually pull out the sword about when they're 30 years old and start pushing it that way because it becomes more like golf.
That was the most controversial thing that it was hit with me a lot hard, but the young people that were actually drawing swords, not only in competition, but just drawing, unless they were under supervision. But that's a good point that you made. It is for an older group in Japan. Now, let me ask you one other question.
Yeah.
And I've got to ask it. And we're going to bring him up a little bit later, but the legend of Miyamoto Musashi, that he used two swords. I know that he was also known to use the Bokenkan. So have you heard rumors about that? I heard he had 80 kills or 200 kills. I've heard all different types of stories.
Original kills, he has about 61, but don't count me. He was 13 years old when he started his first kill. He was through spearing because he was a spearer or a spearman at the very beginning. And basically, you know, throughout history, everybody's been going over to him because he was a pretty interesting guy. He wasn't a charismatic guy because he hated everybody, but everybody seemed to like him. Now, there are other Japanese people, or samurai, who have much bigger kill rates, but they just weren't there in the right place in the right time, if that makes any sense.
Would you consider him like an original Ronin?
Yeah, he's probably not the original Ronin, but he's a Ronin with a big R behind his name until, you know, he gained a presence and, you know, got some pettance, if you know what I mean. A stipend, stipend.
Well, I'll talk about him a little bit later when I ask you the legend's name. But who is the person that most influenced you in Japan, and who's the person in America that you're impressed with drawing?
With sword drawing?
Yes, sir.
Well, let's see. As a general rule, the best sword drawing teacher I ever had, and which I witnessed, and I just, you know, jumped at his feet, was Tabuchi Sensei. He's about a 5'5", 5'6" guy. He's probably about 75 now. He looked like a kamikaze pilot, and he was meaner than a kamikaze pilot. And he drew swords so well, and he put out so much resonance that it was amazing. You'd think he's 6'8", 300 pounds, when he wants to put his weight into it. And they're really, really good. Here in the United States, as far as drawing a sword and doing that, it's a whole complete art of itself, and it takes 40 or 50 years to get it down to the simple thing. It takes years and years for most people to get the simplicity and understand it. Everybody makes it harder than it is. So what you see here in the United States is a very beginner looks really, really flashy, but by the time you become seasoned, you don't see the sword go away. You don't see it come out. It's just there, and there it isn't. It's almost boring, unless you're in the middle of a war. And
that's
then
a
all
very
of a sudden,
diplomatic. That's a very diplomatic answer for my friend. So there's not really one person that has impressed you. You just, I understand your answer, but I'm not going to put you in a corner or anything. But
oh, go ahead and put
person,
me in a corner. I don't mind.
Okay,
don't mind
well, is there anyone? Is there any one person that has impressed you in America?
You know, I haven't met too many sword people here in America. Fumio De Muri, he impressed me just because he's a man, you know, and he and I go back before the turn of the century.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was doing sword. And I got the honor last year at the All-Pro Taekwondo Hall of Fame to be inducted with Tadashi Yamashita, who really blew me away back in the 60s, some of his stuff that he did. Another person that I was always impressed with, you may not remember him, his name is Hadi Ochai from Washington Rue.
Yes.
From Upper State, New York.
Yes.
And he was very impressive also.
Yes.
But, you know, not to dwell on it, but all three, except for Demura Sensei, I know Tadashi and I know Hadi, they cut people. They had people go to the hospital. Now, my question is, in Japan, do they do accolades like they do in America with the sword, you know, on the stomach and throat and stuff like that?
Not really. It's more entertainment over here. It is an entertainment over there because the first thing you would see is you don't cut fruit with a sword. When I cut that orange or that apple with a sword for Black Belt Magazine.
Black Belt shooting. Yeah. How many practices do you do for that?
One. I mean, if you're going to be spot on, you might as well be spot on. And that's the difference between learning the Japanese way.
Speaking practice. I love it. I love it. One take. That's cool. Now, you cut an orange, not an apple, but an orange, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple of times, but it was a grapefruit, if I remember, a small grapefruit. And it just cut it really well. And it explained away the difference between what Iaido and Batodo was. Iaido is, you know, sword drawing.
Explain Bato and Iaido.
Well, Iaido is basically, let's look at it this way. Iaido would be more like your Aikido or your Yale student who wears a sweater and polo pants and, you know, try to be prim and proper and sociable. And they draw really well, and it's really fine, and it's nice. Bato is made for the guys who drink beer, they sweat a lot, they jam out the sword and make a cut and put it back before you can blink your eye. And that's sort of the difference. If you're doing Iaido, they look at the Batodo guys as, you know, Yapanjin, you know, unruly guys.
But the Bato guys are more dangerous.
You know, if you're going to have a Marine, he's going to be that
guy.
Yeah. But, you know, the other guys, they do really, really well themselves. It's just that I just pursued the more rudimentary, fundamental, practical application way.
Yeah, I always saw that the guys who did, well, they call it pure eye or pure Iaido, were they really dangerous enough much to match against who you just mentioned? And they're not. Because I believe that the one who practices the most is the one that is the most proficient. But anyway, let's go to this and go to my next question. I want to explain to the listeners the difference between the tanto, the wakizashi, the grunto, and the katana. and explain that in light detail for me.
Starting basically, the Tanto is an 18-inch knife, usually 6-inch handle, 12-inch blade, give or take an inch or two. They could be longer and shorter.
But it's distinctly cut on the tip. Explain that.
I couldn't hear you.
It's distinctively cut on the tip differently than any other knife.
Not really.
So
I mean, the Kisaki on it is
blade.
A little duller looking. It isn't as sharp looking, but it's in proportion to the knife.
The shape of the Tanto. It always
yeah.
turns out as different. That's what I'm saying.
So, oh, yes, yes.
It was made to go in and rip.
Pardon me?
It was made to go in and rip or slash or...
Tanto is a little bit more for, it was your traditional knife. It was your derringer if you were a cowboy. It was something you hardly ever pulled out. But when you did, it was maybe cut a steak if they had it. It was to keep yourself prepared, open up letters. You know, it was a useful knife that they used around for different stuff. Down the road when they had guntos or some of the longer swords, you always saw on the side maybe a couple of darts or dirks that they had, little knives. Instead, so there's lots of different designs.
The next level, then, is the next level gunto or wakizashi.
A wakizashi is the next level. That's usually a 24-inch, give or take, blade with about an 8-inch handle, 6 to 8-inch handle. And this one was the wakizashi, which means waki is side, and sashi is from stick, so basically side sticker. Real basic language there, so you don't have to worry about thinking of something really hard. It's real
Did
simple
they
language.
With it?
Pardon me?
Did they sleep with it or leave it outside without the katana? Did they sleep with it? Or
they no, they didn't
front?
Sleep with it, but
no,
they kept
they didn't
it.
Sleep
yeah.
with it? Okay.
They didn't sleep with it. It'd be hard to sleep with. It's like you sleeping with a shotgun. You can do it.
They didn't sleep with any weapon. Samurai didn't sleep with any weapons at all.
Well, let's put it this way. Your sword was right near the head of the bed, and if
oh,
you were
so
a well-to-do samurai, you'd have guards in front of the doors anyway.
Okay.
If you were a ronin, or not a ronin, if you were a poor samurai, no one's going to be jamming on you that much anyway, unless you owe money.
Shion, you know I know the answer. I got to ask the question for the listeners who don't know the answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, going back to the wakizashi, the next one is gunto. Explain
yeah,
that.
Yeah, gunto. Now, the gunto is basically the length of the blade is between 24 and, say, 26, 28 inches, but the handle is a little longer than a wakizashi and a little shorter than a katana or, you know, a shinken. And the reason why is because when they went into military, they didn't need the long handles anymore because it was in the 1920s. And they didn't ride horses as much, and they had to deal with machinery. So if they had long handles coming out, they'd knock them all around, and they tried to make it more streamlined for your NCOs and your officers. So
good.
That's where they
right.
went to a gunto that way. And basically with a gunto, the cool thing about a gunto was you could use one hand or you could use two if you tightened up your hand and your grip.
Now you have a favorite gunto. Tell me about the one that you own.
Oh, the one gunto I got was from Tabuchi Sensei, the guy that taught me a lot of really
yeah.
cool short sword, drawing, and I got it from him. And it was a model that was made in 1925, and it's
Ooh.
A nice model. A matter of fact, that's the model I used when I cut that the orange or grapefruit for Black Belt Magazine.
It's also the one you used when we did the live interview at the Masters Hall of Fame.
Hey, it's always nice to bring around a real katana or a real gunto that has all the seals, that has all the license and everything. You know, you hear about that they license swords and this, that, and the other, but you don't hear about it. You almost think it's an urban legend. No, they have them. It's just it's like carrying a firearm over there. If you don't have it registered, well, they'll talk to you twice.
Wow. Okay. Now, the most controversial of all the swords that was most of the general public knows about, even the ignorant public, is the katana.
Yeah.
And there's such a life behind that blade and what it stands for and what it is. Within a synopsis, tell me about your feeling toward it and the buildup of the draw. of it.
Well, that's one of my favorite weapons because that goes hand in hand with kendo, the length of it, which is a little shorter. But it's a nice balance, and it's a guy's weapon. A guy picks that up with his hands, and he goes, yeah, I like this. A short sword is fine. A gunto is there if you need it, if you need a second gun. But when it comes to holding a katana, and remember to your listeners, it isn't katana. Everybody says katana because that's the English pronunciation. It's katana, and you drop the language, katana, like that. And then a Japanese person will go, oh, you mean the sword, okay. But when you say katana, everybody starts saying Mosquito Valley.
It's the Americanized
Mosquito Valley.
Version. The Americanized version, okay.
Yeah,
cool.
Americanized, which happens, you know.
Now
it happens like that.
The,
now,
what are the legends of a sword in battle being broken? I haven't heard too many stories.
Well, you won't hear that many stories because in the real life, few people drew sword in battle, maybe 5, 8%. And the reason why is because everybody else had spears, bows and arrows, and, you know, that type of weaponry that was a little bit more long distance. And by the time you pulled out a sword, you were really close. And a lot of those battles didn't really go like that. So the sword seemed to become more famous during the Edo period when everybody started thinking about duels and doing it that way.
Right.
But remember,
right,
too, there's tons and tons and tons of stuff out there. It's just that what's in English is just the mainstream, you know.
Right.
So there's lots
that's
of different versions.
People see.
You know.
Yeah, we're probably not a lot of us won't ever really know the real stories, no matter how
well,
much.
Well, here's a good example. When I went over there, I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, I knew I was going to do sword, but I didn't know, you know, because I didn't have the experience. And people asked me this recently, too, is, you know, you went over there and you learned kendo through the Department of Education and Recreation, and you got all your stuff through there. But that's Gendai, which means modern version. And they code you as the only place for us, you know, but it's, you got to be an 800-year-old Japanese guy to practice that stuff because if you don't weren't born in that era, how can you practice that era? But there are people today in Japan that their fathers practiced different arts. So when I went to Nitai Dai, which was the best martial art university in Japan, especially for kendo. So if you were going to play kendo and you played kendo in Kai school, like we talked about, and you were on the kendo team and you were the captain and you got you a scholarship at the best university in the country, you'd end up going there. But chances are your dad was some type of swords person just because there's 127 million people in Japan and at least 10 million people practice the sword in one way or another. And you know there's a consistent 1 million black belts just in kendo alone practicing the Seite series. So that's all homogenized. But when I started working with these guys or practicing with these kids, you know, 18 to 22 to 26-year-olds for their masters too, you know, one kid would have Tenshin Senden Shinto Ryu, or another kid would be coming in and, what's your style? Oh, my country style, because everybody came from different parts of Japan, but they call it their own country. It was the interesting thing. In America, what state are you from? Over there, what country are you in?
Right,
because,
right.
And then someone, well, I come from the country of da-da-da, and I do Shinkage-ryu, or Ichiden-ryu, or Omori-ryu, or Shinden-ryu. But the cool thing about it is when you start working with all these different guys, learning all the different styles that you could only dream about, and then one guy's standing in front of me, and he has his sword down towards my forearm, and I go, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm practicing Onoda Kenshin-ryu. Or you say to a guy, why are you holding the sword, tip of the sword in your stomach? Oh, I'm doing Munen-ryu. Or why do you point it at the throat? That's how I do it. I do it pointing at the throat. That's Ito-ryu. Or Fushi-shin-ryu. That's pointing it between the eyes. Or Yagyu. You've heard of Yagyu. Yagyu-ryu.
Yeah,
the Yagyu style, where they bend forward in a really low stance, like you saw in some of those pictures and stuff like that. Or the Motu style, where the style of no style. So there's
lots of
different terms.
Really, yeah. Hey, well, I got a question right before we go to a little break. The Senai, the leather tip and the bamboo split, how dangerous is that? And what have you seen done with it to make it a dangerous weapon?
Well, let's look at it this way. When you take four or eight links of bamboo and don't sand it. You put four together, or you take a piece of bamboo and you just cut it down the middle four times or eight times, depending if it's a Hatsuwari or a Yotsuwari. You cut it down, and if you don't put sand it or bevel it right, you hit someone with that. That bamboo will just sit there and cut you like little razor blades. That's one thing. Second of all, if you don't have that tip on the end, the leather tip, it all falls apart because it doesn't hold together. But that keeps it from splintering and going into your face and eyes and, you know, really deep splinters into your skin.
Vicious weapon. It is a vicious weapon.
Oh, it is. It is. But as a general rule, where you can buy one at the store and you hold it, it hurts if you cry when someone looks at you cross-eyed. Otherwise, if you're all honed and you're ready to go and someone hits you on the hand and it hurts, well, yeah, but you shouldn't be thinking about that, and you should be going in for the point. So there's the good points and the bad points. If you go to a Hatsuwari, which is a little bit shorter than a Shinai, and it's what they were using for centuries, and it's, you know, it is a, let's see, a Shinai Bukuro, and you can get them online and stuff. And they offer more of a kenjutsu traditional way because you start going more at angles instead of, you know, linear with the kendo.
You know, I believe that that it's not just the physical weapon, but the presence of the weapon. I used to take the Shinai, and I remember there'd be, I don't know, 100 people in the room, and they'd all be talking. You'd ask them to be quiet. You'd even ki once or twice, and there's always someone still talking. I take that Shinai, and if you make it flat to the table, it makes a loud gun sound. It's not made by any other weapon. We did it at the Super Show that year, I remember. And it's loud. So a vicious weapon, not only physically, but also in preparation and sound. With that said, I'm going to take a small commercial break. Dana, I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to talk a couple of things. Stay online, okay?
All right.
I'm gonna bring up a couple of questions from my email, one of our new segments, and I want you to be a part of that too.
But before
we start, I'd like to talk about a couple of shows that are coming up. We've got the Super Show. We'll start off with Bill Wallace's Superfoot Tournament put together by Don DeVries and Richard McClain. That'll be March 31st and April 1st in Cleveland, Ohio. And then we got the Super Show, of course, at the MGM, new location this year. It'll be in Las Vegas, Nevada, July the 6th to the 8th. And it's the largest industry show of its kind. Dana, you'll be there, I'm sure, doing your seminars and doing your expertise. A lot of fun to watch. Then we got Nick Chamberlain's Gathering of the Eagles, which has been given to him by Mr. Al Tracy in Dallas, Texas. He's also going to be hosting the Kempo Hall of Fame August 11th, 12th, and 13th. And that'll mark your calendar for that because we've got to tell you the location a little bit later in the year. Going to write into some of our emails. It's really interesting. I've done the show now quite a few times, and we're starting to get emails. And for anyone who'd like to ask a question, I'll be more happy to answer if it gets on the air. And you can do that by contacting Professor Gary Lee at gmail.com, and I will answer all my emails that are sent in. The first one is from Jeremy from Winnie, Wisconsin. And Dana, this might portray to you because I know you did some stunt work. Jeremy says, how many guys from sport karate made it to the movies and stunt work? Well, right off the bat, I think people like Keith Vitale, Don Wilson, Jerry Tremble, who started in Heat with Al Pacino, Leo Fawn, Ron Marchini, Joe Louis, of course, rest in peace. But the stunt work guys, they're still working. I still see their names on blockbusters in 2015-16, and that's people like James Liu, Hiro Kota, Howie Long, the great Joe Hess. Jeff Amato was on a recent, Ninja Turtle flick.
Yeah.
You've got to give credit also to the great choreographers of our time, people like Pat Johnson and people who really stepped up and who did amazing stuff. I mean, Pat did the Karate Kid movie, Ninja Turtles, the early ones, the first ones, and got a feeling Ernie Reyes Jr., he actually played a turtle, started in Ninja 2. So with that question. I think that answers it. There's been quite a few people, and all around the country that walked from sport karate events, made their claim and fame, and then eventually found by Hollywood. Now, you did some stunt work in a movie, Dana. What was that?
It was called Dead Men. It was a real fun movie. I haven't seen it yet, just because everything stays in production for a long time. You know how that is. But it was great.
Yeah.
Got to ride horses, got to shoot guns, got to chase Indians, got to be chased by Indians, got killed, and it was good. It was really, really good.
Well, cool.
And this was down in Tombstone, Arizona.
I think everyone that does martial arts needs to try and do one movie. It's hurry up and wait. That's what the key of making a movie, isn't it? Hurry
oh, it
up
is. It's hurry
wait.
Up and wait. You know, that 3 minutes of scene took 4 days.
And a couple of scenes I've done in the past, I think the longest one is 32 takes.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that quite distinctly. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning when we finished. And no one complained because they had fun, but I was thinking 32 takes, man. That's hard. Perfect
it's
producer.
Hard. When I've done video clips for our websites in the university, you know, I go through those and just make them perfect because everything has to be. If it isn't, you know, everybody would lose interest. So we make it a point to have all our stuff just spot on.
There's always a hater out there that always says that you're not doing it right. Hey, here's a second question, little brother.
Yeah.
And again, this applies to I guess, us a little bit.
Yes.
I don't think you've ever done a sport competition with a draw, but I certainly have. But here we go. From Tom from Greenville, South Carolina, he asks, are swords real in competition? And then he said, talk about NBL and NASCAR and other circuits. Well, to answer that, Tom, I can say this. I was a pioneer sword drawer in the NBL, and they actually made a rule, I think it was the fourth year of NBL, where no live swords were allowed. And the founder, Mr. Liddell, wanted us to tape our sword blades before it went to the sheath. It was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. And, of course, a lot of guys did it. A lot of guys switched to non-live blades. But I can only tell you what I did. For many years, and I competed in NBL to 2002 and did the sword up to the very end, I would go through my ritual, Shion, and
yeah.
I would put it in my hakama, and it was there. And when a judge came up to me and simply said, Mr. Lee, we must check your sword if it's real or not, I would simply say, well, it's already been blessed. I've already gone through the ritual. You can't really look at it until I draw it out.
Yeah.
And most of them would walk away. And, of course, I never used a non-life sword in one day of my competition.
Yeah.
Now, I don't recommend anybody to do that, but that's what I did. And I know nowadays that a lot of the swords are fake, and a lot of them are real lightweight, and there's not really anybody. The real people in the draw really don't do competition unless it's traditional competition.
People who draw are people who play golf. There's very few in competition. They go out there for a nice, friendly game to reconnect with their thoughts, basically, is what it is. It's sort of
Dana, you and I talked about this, and I lived in both worlds. I was an entertainer, and I was a traditional martial artist, and I did do both. I did draw the sword for entertainment. There's proof of that on YouTube. And
yes.
I did make people laugh because that's what I was being paid for. But also, whenever I did competition, it was 99% pure draw, and I knew it was 1% entertainment. But in my heart, I was doing it very traditional as best I could. I will tell you one story, and then we'll go back to your interview. I was at a tournament in San Antonio, Odie Molina's tournament, and this kid was doing a sword, and he was dropping it, and he was touching the blade, and he's putting it upside down in his sheath, and
it happens all the time.
But it was late 70s, early 80s, and I just moved to Texas, and I just really, really was upset at this kid. But I didn't do anything. I'm not going to mention his name, but one of those real martial artists, in fact, a real sword drawer, I'll just say his last name, Mr. Tatum, walked over to him and said, if you do that to my sword again, talking to the kid, and he had his sword in his hand. He says, if you do that to my sword again, you're going to have to deal with my attitude. And I never saw the kid again at a tournament. I get to talk to him again, and he just really put him in his place. And, you know, it hurts me sometimes when I see how people misuse a sword in open competition, but there's nothing, you know, I can do about it. All I can do is just, you know, feel for them because they've never really experienced a live draw before.
Well, you know, drawing and working.
Tom,
yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So drawing and working in competition is, you know, sort of interesting, but to be really truthful, using real swords in competition, yeah, it was used all the time. It was called war. And everybody competed for war, and everybody got cut on it. But when it got into pre-war or competition, they usually used wood or bamboo because when you went and you crossed swords, say it is a mogito, a dull metal sword, or a shinken, a steel sword, or even a piece of wood, because everybody's tried this before, and you hit the swords together or block, make a couple blocks and hit and go back and forth, and you look at the weapon, and the wood's bashed up a little bit, or the mogito, it's all, you know, chipped, or the shinken, it's all bruised, and the yakiba and everything's off a little bit. Well, if those are real swords, and they had competitions a long time ago, you'd be looking at the sword 10 years later and go, that was a screw-up. And look at this. Who the hell did, how did I get that then? Or that's really bad. So you could see that very seldom they cross swords because the outcome would be, is going to be a lot of sword polishing over the next 10 years to get that chip out.
Yeah. Well, Tom, you know, from Greenville, South Carolina, I hope that Dana answered your question, and we're looking forward to answering more emails as the shows go on. Well, getting back to my special guest, Dana Abbott, I've got to, right off the bat, I like to talk about 47 Ronin and your adventure there in writing that, and what was your vision in writing that, and also how did the Sport Karate Museum and my artwork portray in that adventure?
Well, of course, your artwork was spot on. I just saw it, and I went, ooh,
thank you.
Good for me. Ooh, that was a little bit like that, so we worked it in.
Yeah.
The book is a real nice, tight, short read. It's a fiction read because, you know, it sets back, you know, 400 years ago. But what I'd like you to know is that it is written for people who don't need all that crappy fluff. You know, I could have written a 200-page book and had the humpty 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 this and do that, but I made it right down. If you want to see a sword fight, read this book, and you'll have your sword fight within the first couple of pages.
It was cool.
Hey, that's the way guys think. That's the way we have to be in martial arts.
Tell my listeners how to get it and get that cool artwork that I can share with you. How do they get it? Tell them.
I couldn't hear you. What?
How do they get the book?
How do they get the book?
How do they get it?
It's on Kindle, so all you have to do is go into Amazon, look underneath the 47th with a TH, Ronin. And it's, you know, by me, and it's a little paperback. And no, it's not even a paperback. It's just an electronic book. And it didn't have enough pages for a paperback. And but it's a nice, tight little read. You can read in an hour, hour and a half. It's not it's not expensive. I don't even know what the price is.
It's cheap.
It's cheap, like 78 cents or something like that.
I mean, it's cheap, man.
It's
unreal.
Cheap.
It's so
a nice
cool.
read. It's a nice, cheap read. Yeah, and it sets in really, really well. Also, since you were talking about the 47th Ronin, you know, a lot of that thought process came from all the different stuff I dealt with in Japan and all the different people. And like we were talking about Miyamoto Musashi back a while back, and, you know, Ganryu-jima. And Ganryu-jima is where they had the, you know, famous, you know, fight with when he had the oar and he beat on Sashiro or whatever. Sashiro? Yeah. Anyway, what I'd like you to know is a lot of students and a lot of people go, well, where can I see this Miyamoto Musashi? Where can I find training? Where can I go to see the continuance of what he did 400 years ago? And, of course, there's places in Japan. There's one in Kyushu where he was raised and everything, and there's a city right – actually, Ganryu-jima is just right next to a larger city, and the name of the city is Shimonosekishi. And that place, they have a fire department, And in their fire department, the head fire department, the person, the fire chief or the captain, the person that runs the whole shebang there, and it's about a seven-story fire department, and it's big. This is a bigger one for this area. And the soke that, or the head teacher or the person that has received a lot of Miyamoto Musashi stuff, they don't teach sword as far as, you know, I'm a private teacher. I'm a cop or I'm a fireman or a military and I do this. So anyway, the whole fire department practices Itoryu there. And we used to go down there about once a year when we do the competition on Ganjujima. And that was really, really fun. But if you want to really see Miyamoto Musashi stuff, all you have to do is go over to, you know, Shimonosekishi and their fire department and talk to them and say, I want to learn some katas. I want to learn this, that, and the other. And it works in well. Although I noticed, though, that these people don't fight as much. You know, they weren't the hardcore fighters like you might have seen in the Showa era, just because, you know, it's a new era.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, and anyway, what the other Shima's really well known for, it's the pufferfish capital of the world, you know, where they eat fugu. So they can go down there and eat pufferfish and get drunk on eating pufferfish.
That's the poisonous fish. For my listeners who don't know, the most poisonous fish in the world. And you have to have a special degree or license to be able to take that and make sushi. Yeah, to make that sushi to be able to serve it to the general public. And only certain restaurants have that license.
Yeah, you can't be a white belt or a green belt and do it. Well, you can do it.
Well, listen,
will they eat it?
I want to talk about the drinking problem, guys, for a minute.
Oh, the Hashtown Terriers?
The Hashtown Terriers. Tell me about them and your affiliation with those crazy guys.
Well, I ran into those guys in China when I was back in the 80s. And basically, they're just a bunch of expatriates that live in a different country. Or when I went, because I dealt with them back in the 80s, and this was back where Vietnam vets, like the Rambo types, they never went home. So a lot of them ended up in, you know, Taiwan, Philippines. A lot of them ended up in Thailand or China. And, you know, it's a Hash House Harriers.
No,
it's
all about,
you know,
Americans, right?
Well, some of them are Americans. A lot of them were that countries, or there are a bunch of military people from a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Now, tell me about exactly what they do.
Well, basically, it's a drinking club with a running problem. So they're hardcore runners, but they drink like fish. And then after, you know, you drink like fish, and then
but
since
you
live
in
a different area.
Correct?
Pardon?
You run at night. You don't run in the daytime. You run at night.
Well, you run during the day for the people that like to see where they're running, and when it gets too dangerous to run, that's when you run at night so you can't see how dangerous it is.
And there's no
and
limit.
If you don't come out
you
of the jungles
everywhere
with leeches all over your body, you didn't run that day. You
well,
know.
But is there alumni of these guys around the world?
Oh, they're all over the place. You know, I did the hardcore stuff, you know, with the expatriates and, you know, the old Rambo types. But they have stuff even in your neighborhood. If you look underneath Hash House Harriers in any neighborhood, anybody that's listening on the phone now, they'll find it. And just say that, hey, I found you guys, and I want to drink a beer and walk and run. You know, and there's lots of different philosophies with it. But basically it was an old English SAS hair of the dog orientation thing back in the 1930s.
Well, that leads me into coming back to America.
Yeah.
And, of course, you got a Ronin Samurai. I'm not calling you a Ronin offensively. But I do that out of love. But you got a Ronin Samurai. He's in America now. He's training in Japan. He's got this training and got this yearning for something another. And all of a sudden, here we come, Samurai Sports. Tell me how that began and your vision of that, and then lead into the famous sport you introduced, which Kintsugi is a big, big, big supporter of you, the Chambara sport.
The Chambara sport is really, really cool because it allows people to get in there and cross swords with not that much education and practice. You know, in traditional kendo and traditional swordsmanship, you started at 4 or 5 years old. You practice just one hit until you're 9 or 10, and maybe you might start fighting. Otherwise, it was just swinging the sword and really mundane for most students. Although, with new technology, for example, in kendo, remember, 200 years ago, people that practiced kendo were a bunch of girls. It wasn't traditional. Only girls practiced kendo. He wouldn't practice this crap, their samurai would say. Now it's a tradition. Go figure. So what happened is they used bamboo, and then they started going to carbon chenilles in the late 1970s, which is, you know, sort of a plastic or a synthetic. And then from there, with the kendo stuff, they vacillated back and forth, but then they started dealing with foams and plastics and other nylons and things like that. And they found out that if they used the products and balanced them out well, they could create swords for chambara. And chambara was just basically, chambara means swashbuckly in Japanese.
Yes.
The word chan is the cling of the sword. Where we say cling clang when we hit two metal things together, they go chan, chan, chan. So if you take two swords and you hit them together, it's going to go chan, chan, chan. And bara comes from basically bara, bara, which means to break down and fall apart. So think of the time when you were a little kid and you saw that neighbor's rose bushes and they were all full of roses and you hit them and they flew and they sort of, the petals came down. So basically, it's the cling of the sword and watching petals fall, and that's the romantic feeling behind it. For kids, they've been doing it with sticks since for millennia or two or three, and now they were able to create sticks that the kids wouldn't put their eyes out with, and they working a little bit differently.
You wear headgear, and some guys wear arm pads, and they're protected. But you guys, I saw it at the Super Show a few years back, really watched it intensely. Particularly you and your son, very, very close to exact kendo, very, very expert strikes, very decisive strikes, very impressive.
Oh, thanks. Well, that's because I have a kendo background, but then again, if you want to go at it at a different background, it's okay. It's just instead of polishing from the top down, from the bottom up, you'll polish from the top down.
A chance to understand. I understand it completely. Now, go back. We're going to ask this question backwards now. How did you have the vision of samurai sports coming to America? What year you start that? And
well,
that's probably the year when I became your friend.
Here's what happened. They sent Japanese people over to the United States in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And Japanese, I can honestly say their English abilities aren't the best. They just don't speak English well enough to pull people in. And then I was thinking about moving back to the U.S. because the kids, you know, we had kids and stuff like that. And Mari, you know, my wife, she never saw America. So I figured, hey, let's go back and do something. Well, the teachers started pushing me, saying, well, why don't you go back and do this or do it this way and that way because your English is really good. And it was. And we were able to take samurai sports up to the next level. Now, the reason we called it samurai sports is because it was a cool name. And it's sport. It's a sport that deals with the samurai. And I was speaking with that to my teacher back in 1995, to Tanabe Sensei. And he goes, you know, what about samurai sports? Samurai sports wa inamai da ne to. Anyway, that's another story. So anyway, that's what got it in there. And the hardest part about saying samurai sports here in the United States is no one can spell it. That's the hard one. That's why we have our Action Flex equipment, because everybody can spell Action Flex.
When you go to
samuraisports.com, if you're a teacher, it's samuraisports.com.
Yeah, if you spelled sports sports, everybody would get it. Thank goodness you did Samurai Sports, though, because for the past quite a few years, you know, from day one.
20 years I've had that website up.
Yeah, we've been friends over 20 years. I remember that. And I remember the cool stuff you used to send me and you'd bring back from Japan and you'd give me.
Forget me not.
Yeah. Well, the really cool stuff. That's going to lead me into some other cool moment, and that's the, I'm going to call it the famous Legends Name Game that we do now on the show.
Yeah.
And I'm going to name some names and paragraph or less, and I might throw my two cents in because there's some really special people. And I know there some of them are part of your life, some of them you know who they are, and I want your opinion of them. So we're going to start with the first one. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Legends Name Game. Here we go with Dana Abbott. First one.
Oh, I know him. He's a nice guy.
First one, Mrs. Dana Stamos.
Oh, Dana's really nice person. One of the best people you will ever meet. She was been in the martial art industry, and she has put martial arts on the map as far as the web and getting it out there and doing it correct. So when you work with USADojo.com or the university or anything like that, she's the go-to person, and the best thing about it is she's not flaky, and she gets stuff done today. Most people in every business in this new day and age has an excuse to say, your hand came or anything like that. She doesn't sound like that. She said, you know why? She's old school.
Well, you know, I was with her from the very beginning, and the bios of all the sport karate legends she allowed me to do, and I thank her so much for letting me be a part of that. And she's also literally edited quite a few of my stories. She ran it, which still runs, Tales of Kabuki Tales.
Yeah.
And thank her publicly to the world that she is a special, special lady. So I agree with you 100%. How about Toshiro Mifune?
Okay. Toshiro Mifune. Basically, he was an actor, as we all well know, but to the Japanese, back, say, in 1950s and 60s, he was their first version of John Wayne. So if anybody's seen a John Wayne movie and see how tall he stood, and he stood for being a man and, you know, the American spirit and everything like that, that's what Mifune-san, that's what he did over in the Japanese version with his movies and this, that, and the other. So did you know that they wanted Toshiro Mifune to play in Star Wars, but he turned it down because I don't do that kid stuff? A little trivia there. So basically,
yeah,
from the Showa era, from about Showa era was from 1926 to 1985.
Yeah.
And Mifune made it a point to get all the best movies out there. He showed the Japanese spirit. He brought people back to where, you know, the spirit of the samurai was still around, on how guys thought and how people got things done. It's different today, but back then, they got it done if they killed him or not.
One of my biggest heroes. How about, we talked about him earlier, Miyamoto Musashi.
Miyamoto Musashi? Oh, yeah. Miyamoto Musashi was a character. He didn't like no one. And you remember when you were in high school? Remember during physical education class back in the late 60s, early 70s, there was always that one guy that had the long, greasy hair, and he didn't dress out for gym, and he wore cowboy boots with no socks on out to the gym thing, and he got up to the line, and then everybody ran the half a mile, and he won everybody by 15 lengths, and then walked off and smoked a cigarette, flipped us all off, and went back. And that's how he was a little bit. He looked at those young, expensive samurai, and he just, you know, he just surprised them with really hard, tight, practical, applicated technique. That's all it was. His technique was a technique of surprise and being on him because no one was ready for it.
Wow, good answer. How about our friend and someone who's been a part of the Sport Karate Museum archives from day one and a big part of your life because he sponsors you, is Mike Dillard.
Mike Dillard, yes, Mr. Dillard. I've known him for some time. I've known him more from about 2007 when we started working with them and Century with all our products, so I didn't have to go around and, you know, slug products all over the country and the world. So that really helped. I worked with Mr. Dillard through Dan Bauer, the president of Century at that time, and, you know, he was my student, so that really made it easy because mostly everything I said, they go, okay, we'll see what happens, and it happened well, and we're all happy with it. And I guess the word was happiness.
Amazing man, starting from a sewing machine in his garage, and the early days. I'm really, really impressed with Mike. You know, I'm going to be interviewing him later on in the season. How about Mr. Al Goldberg, the guy that's called the P.T. Barnum of martial arts shows.
I don't call him that. I call him the measuring stick.
I call him Sifu.
I call him the measuring stick because he's made it a point to make sure there's not a lot of that, you know, flaky ranking stuff around through his stuff. He makes it a point, if you have rank and you earned it, we'll show it. But if you haven't earned it, not. So he's like a measuring stick, making sure that a lot of people are what they say. So that's really good. He and I go back before the turn of the century, but in 2004, he and I were, inductinated into the Black Belt Magazine Hall of Fame. He was Kung Fu, and I was weapons instructor.
Well, his instructor, Jason Lau.
Yes.
And I had the pleasure, it might have been Michael DePasquale's verse, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Backstage, I actually got to see him work, and his hands are incredibly fast.
Yeah.
He knows what he's doing. He is a Wing Chun master.
Yeah.
And besides being a super producer and a great guy, he's he's just one of these super, super guys of martial arts that if you don't get to know him, it'd be kind of a dumb thing to do. Just call him up, and he's very friendly. How about, we got a couple more here. Mr. Mark Shuey, the Game Master.
Oh, Mark, he's a really, really nice guy. You know, he's a hardcore martial artist, you know, that has taken it a long way.
That's the world champion.
He is.
Yeah.
And he and I worked together really, really well. A matter of fact, we started working together after we were at one of your gigs about 7 or 8 years ago over in Texas.
Okay.
And we were just sitting around talking, and we said, well, let's make a video. Okay, well, let's make a video. We started working that way. He's a badass. You should see him swing a cane. You know, he's like, he talks soft and carries a big stick.
Yes,
so,
he does.
Yeah, he works in really, really well. A matter of fact, I should be seeing him in the next couple of weeks. I think over in Las Vegas.
Give my love. He's a future person to interview too. Okay, I got one last one for you. You know, he's a controversial guy, but I call him the Don Rickles of karate because we need laughter in our life. But I know he's a friend of yours. He's a friend of mine. Master Ken.
Oh, Master Ken. Yes, yes.
Master Ken.
Real nice guy. If you can see him away from his character, he's a completely different person. As a matter of fact, most people who see him in character, they see him a few hours later, and he's not in character, and you wouldn't even recognize him. That's how much of a difference it is. Although he works out really well, and he, of course, he does martial arts, and I think he kicks everybody's butt on TV and YouTube because it's really fun. He's done some parodies on my stuff and, of course, our equipment. And, you know, people like that really make the martial arts go around. It can't be all, you know, grunts and tears. It has to be a little fun, and you got to laugh at yourself. So the people who think he's not being politically correct or if he's not doing this, screw them, you know. You got to learn martial arts. It's a testosterone-y thing, and you got to laugh and have a fun time, pull some fingers, and be one of the guys. Because if we were all colonels in the Army, we'd be saying the same exact thing.
Well, you know, Sean, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this talk tonight with you and talking about all the different subjects. And I know you haven't been to Texas in a while, but I'm going to share this with you, and then we're going to kind of go toward the opening of anybody who'd like to call in. And September the 29th and 30th, we're going to be having Kata Wars in Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
Producing as Darlene McPherson Pagels and Support Karate Museum Archives. And we'll be actually taking grand champions from some major tournaments.
Yes.
And having them come to Houston to form a national black belt kata champion. And imagine grand champions from major tournaments like the AMAA Nationals and Ocean State, Tumide Classic, 61 Nationals, Empire Nationals, Battle of Atlanta, Diamond Nationals, Jamal Nationals, Bill Wallace's event, of course, the Capital Classic, and some others, and the Grand Slam Nationals, and taking those grand champions and putting them together on stage and letting them go for a national title. And we're going to do that September 29th and 30th in Houston, Texas. For more information, they call directly at 713-483-0476. A real national black belt kata championship established by the best of the best from all the tournaments around the country. Now, I always end the show with a question that we'll save after the call-ins. If we have anybody to call in, Uncle Jesse, Bowen, are you there, please?
I guess we're still alone.
Okay. Jesse, are you still there? Are you there? I guess we're alone.
Hello?
Jesse?
You're not alone.
Yeah, has anybody called in for Dana?
Guys.
Yeah.
We have some people on the line, so if you'd like to, this is that time that it's open for you to ask questions.
I'll answer anything people want to ask.
Hey, Gary Lee, this is Daryl Stewart from Texas.
Yes.
Hey, Daryl Stewart. I got another
How you doing?
On the line. Good. Dana Abbott.
Yes.
I've been listening to you and Dana for about the last 20, 30 minutes. That's a really interesting conversation that I learned a lot just listening to y'all.
Well, good.
A sword man. He's a sword man, Dana. He's done a draw or two and wore a hakama. Daryl Stewart?
Nowhere near close to you, though, Dana. But
I'm just anal retentive when it comes to pulling things out. That's all. You know, it's just application. It's not talent, I don't think. It's just 40 years of getting hit correctly.
Yeah.
Say
I remember meeting you out at the California Hall of Fame. There. I was wearing the Texas hat. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I run into people from Texas all the time. As a matter of fact, a guy from El Paso is coming out this weekend.
All right. That's good.
Yeah. So anything that you want to know about SWORD, here's my personal email for everybody. It's Shihan, Shihan, my last name, Abbott. So that's Shihan Abbott. @hotmail.com. If you guys have any questions about anything that deals with practical application, or if you have a hard time with you're on a plateau, or you have a question that no one can answer, pretty much I can explain it to you within a short amount of time. And that's why they sent me back here, because I can explain it in the simplest manner, because that's the way it should be.
And what's
all right.
There's no charge.
No charge at all. This is all free. Because, see, my education in Japan was free. I didn't pay – I paid $200 to get into the university. But after that, it was my blood, sweat, and tears. And that's why they sent me back here, because I'm not here to make a fortune. I'm here to make sure that if you're going to learn sword, you might as well learn it that the people in Japan, they'll see it and they'll go, oh, that's nice. Bring tear to
the
old guy's face.
You're an extremely cool dude. You hear me, Dana? You're an extremely cool dude. You're an extremely cool dude, even though you got a girl's name.
You know how it goes. Jackie and Bruce and all the other boys, you know. Dana.
Well, Daryl, thanks for calling in, buddy. Thanks for calling in. And I wish you a happy holiday, and I'll talk to you real soon.
Okay, you and Dana both. Y'all have a happy holiday. See you later.
You have a happy holiday yourself there.
Okay, man.
You bet.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Anybody else on the line, Jesse?
A couple more people.
All right.
Okay, cool. Hello? You're on the air.
Somebody speak up.
You're on the air. This is what radio they call blank spot. Is someone
there?
It happens.
Professor Lee?
Yes, sir.
This is Kenny Repstock. With the Cancer
Kenny.
Warrior Program. How you doing, sir?
Doing good, Kenny. How are you?
Doing great. I was just going to let you know that we're getting some network coverage tomorrow. We're going to be doing a Cancer Warrior Program at Billy Smith's Karate here in Burleson, Texas. And local station KTVT will be there to video the ceremony. And anybody that's listening, if they want to see the ceremony, if they don't live in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, they could probably go to KTVT's website and see it. So we're excited.
Dana,
we're going to have
What Kenny does, Dana, is
yes.
He honors kids that have cancer and honors them with a black belt and gets incredible people like Billy Smith, Steve Parks, Todd James, Richard Morris, other well-known people to support this group, and we actually introduced it this year at Living Legends.
Every year we
honor that. And Kenny, let me say this to you publicly. You know, I want you to be the first to know, and all my listeners, you're getting a special award this year. It's called the Gem Fighting Irishman Henderson Passion Award. And that award is given out to people who are very passionate about what they do and do things for the unselfishness. I mean, to do things for other people. And that's what you've done. And I've talked to Mr. Anderson, and that's what I'm going to do this year, is give you that passion award at the Living Legends 25th anniversary. So congratulations. And
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
No,
well,
thank you for all your help and support.
Yes,
you know,
I
and
mean,
if Daryl's still listening on the...
Yeah, I'm listening. Go ahead.
Yeah, I haven't forgotten those names that you gave me, and I'll be getting those to you before Christmas.
That'll work.
Okay. I found the note that you gave me. I'd lost it, and I found it, but I'll be getting the belt and the certificates to you before Christmas. How about that?
That'll work. That'll work.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
No problem. And Daryl, I'm the best middleman in America. This just proves
you are, Gary Lee. I agree. You definitely are.
I love you guys. I love you guys. Well, listen, we got time for one more caller. Anybody else on the line?
Before someone says that, I just want to say that I got my AMAA Who's Who in the martial arts book, and I've been looking all over through it, and it's great. I'm on page 160 to let everybody know. But nevertheless, I'm reading all the different artists and the legends and everybody, and I'm reading this, and I go, I didn't know they did that. Oh, this is cool information. Oh, I didn't know he did that. Wow, he's that old? You know, things like that. So this book is a whole complete guide.
And remember, if you go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon and you type in the book, you can buy two books. And Mr. Jesse Bowen will give you one free for your purchase tonight to listen to the show.
Sounds like a good deal.
Is anybody else on the line? One more caller?
No, I think that's it there. And, thank you. That was great. We're very grateful for you to submit your bio so we could put it in the book. Again, you know, you are one of those legends of the martial arts that, you know, that I really follow. And, you know, this is what the show's about. The show's about acknowledging martial artists, just like tonight's a platform for people to become educated about the martial arts from a lot of different perspectives, not just one of just the karate side or the taekwondo side or the MMA side.
Yes.
But this is the general knowledge. That's the reason why we're trying to promote the Martial Arts History Month, because there's never been something like that. We want people to just to take a moment and be thankful for who they are, call their previous teachers, share a story with their students. You know, share this call tonight with your students. Maybe you have students that are, you know, thinking about doing sword work, and maybe you do sword work, but there's a whole nother level to the training and knowledge that you may not have. So the information that's on the call tonight, then that you provided, is, you know, really great information, but it's a part of the education. So if someone says, what's the purpose of the radio show? Well, the purpose of the radio show is for education, and is for motivation, that when people hear our guest that's on, you know, on Thursday I'm going to do another show and talk to Professor Gary Lee about, you know, we're doubling up before Christmas, so we can really get some good information as we share this. But we're going to have Hunchy Larry Isaac out of Jacksonville, North Carolina. He's going to be on a call, and we're going to have Grandmaster Bill Hayes. You know, he's going to be on a call on Thursday, and that's what we're doing. You know, we talk a lot about the, you know, about our American sport karate and the things that we have. So we're trying to build some balance of talk about the traditional side, and that's like tonight was so much information and so enlightening to for you to share your experience with us. So, again, you know, we definitely would like to say, you know, thank you for being a guest on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Big thank you, Dana. And, you know, excuse me, I believe that our show is going to be balanced. That's what we want to do throughout the year, is not only do sport karate, but also talk about the philosophy and the attitude of Karate Do in general, and the things that are the aspect of it. You know, you have done something really tremendous in America. You've educated people, and I love the humbleness of you, of still teaching, still passing on, still asking anybody in America to call you up. Don't charge them. Just give them the information, because very humbly you learned it from Japan, and you weren't charged. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And I'd like to say this in the closing statements, is if you like tonight's show and you like what you hear, you can be part of it. Mr. Bowen and I are creating a new program. We'll actually do commercials for your project, for your event, for your tournament, for anything that you'd like us to advertise on the show. And it's approved by Jesse and myself. And these are going to be 3 packages. And for more information, you call Mr. Bowen directly, and you can keep reaching him at 919-618-8075. You can actually advertise on our radio shows that we do on Tuesday and the last Tuesday of the month. One last thing, thank you for all the listeners, and thank you for the emails. If you do want to send an email and ask a question for the show, send it to Professor Gary Lee at gmail.com, or you directly call me at 713-483-0476. And the last question that we have for Dana is a question I do with every guest. It's a 2-part question. First part is, someone comes in, very respectful. They take their shoes off. You know they have some type of training. They walk up to you and say, Mr. Abbott, what do I need to do to learn how to do the sword? What would you say to them?
Basically, I'd say take off your shoes if they were already off, and here's a sword, and let's start you off right now on the five-strike kihon. And if they can pass through that without staring at the clock or looking around for at least 10 minutes, I know they're semi-serious. And if they can last an hour and start working on a rote memory, I know that there might be some possibilities, because everybody wants to learn the sword, but very few people want to put in the effort, because it does take a lot of effort.
So the second part is just the opposite. Someone comes in with shoes. They've been walking out in the mud. They walk on the floor. They walk up to you and say, hey, are you the sword guy? Hey, wait a minute. Hey, you got a sword on, of course. Hey, I want to learn how to do a sword. Teach me how to do a sword. How do you handle someone like that?
Well, if I was from the U.S., I'd go slap the crap out of him, tell him to get out. If I lived in Japan, I'd go, well, maybe he just doesn't have the – maybe he's Shrek and he wants to come up and eat on the mountaintop. So basically I'd still take off your shoes, let's beat on him for a while and see if they like it. Because remember, Miyamoto Musashi was like the second guy.
Have you ever been confronted, Shihan?
No, not too often. I mean, at all the super shows. Remember when I used to go to all the super shows, and
yeah,
over a 3-day thing, there'd be 2,000 people. I'd probably fight about 300 over a weekend.
Yeah.
So we'd run into some real good wood choppers there that thought they knew everything. You know how that goes. And people that, you know, well, he ain't nothing. And, you know, you hit him a couple of times before they open their eyes, and they go, well, I wasn't ready. You know, so that's the biggest thing. People are never ready, because in kenjutsu, in the sword, the best technique is to surprise them. You come off like a spring, and bang, it's that fast, and the technique is all coming off the line to make sure they're cut before they can even move. So that's
thank
what we want to push
Dana
in.
Abbott.
So, pardon me?
Thank you, Shihan Dita Abbott.
Hey,
for your
thank
answer.
You.
And thank you for being a part of the show tonight. And for more information, please go to www.sportkaratemuseum.org. And also remember that we'll be on the next Tuesday show will be Mr. A.J. Perry from Ohio. With that said, on behalf of the AMAA Pioneers and Legends Network Radio Blog, and Mr. Bowen, who's doing martial arts, my special guest, Ben Abbott. Good night. Night. Merry Christmas to all.
Good night and Merry Christmas.
Good night.
Aloha, brother.